I really don't know how many years I've been coming to the Mount Pelerin, sorry, to the Philadelphia Society meetings, but it's been quite a few. And one of the things that I've noted, with some consistency, certainly not uniformly, but certainly there's a strong tendency, and that is for members of the Philadelphia Society to have a tendency to be highly suspicious of environmentalists. They tend to view environmentalists, we tend to view environmentalists as watermelons, in a sense, people who are green on the outside, but red and seedy within. And what I would like to do is to confirm your suspicions in part, because indeed there is a very strong theme within the environmental movement that's strongly statist, that's strongly anti-business, that's strongly anti-free market. That exists, there's no question about it. But I would like to advise you that, having been involved with this movement for 25 years, sort of on the periphery from their side, but yet that's been central to my work for more than 25 years now, that there really is a shift that has gone on, and a very large portion of the credit for that shift may be attributed directly to the Liberty Fund. It was the Liberty Fund operating initially with Neil McLeod as president, who identified this small remnant band of renegades out in Montana. In how he became aware of us, I'm not quite sure, but I think it was through Ben Rogge. But at any rate, invited us to participate in some of the very early programs that the Liberty Fund ran at UCLA under the direction of Clay LaForce. And Neil became persuaded that possibly, and I remember he was very scared about this, but possibly there would be an opportunity for the Liberty Fund to maybe make a little dent in the environmental movement by sponsoring a set of programs in Montana in which people who were conservative, libertarian, classical, liberal, Austrian, whatever, would try to give their slant on environmental matters. Well, that work started in 1976. And I'm here to tell you that we have won, we have clearly won the intellectual high ground, and I think we're beginning to make some serious inroads in the moral high ground as well. Now, how does this tie in to the theme of this session? And that is the role of the business person in this. And that story is not quite so cheerful. Let me give the outline of that. If you go back and look at the early literature of the modern environmental movement, not the old conservation movement, but the environmental movement in the mid-60s and early 70s and so forth, it was explicitly and overtly and strongly anti-business, anti-capitalist, anti-property rights. You may recall that one of the themes of that movement was property is theft, and so forth. Well, I was convinced, obviously, that was total nonsense and that these people basically didn't understand. And so one of the things that I tried to do, and I began this in the mid-1970s, was to identify business people who had really made serious contributions to conservation, to ecological understanding, to environmental management, to what we would today call sustainable development, and so forth. And so I created an award with the consultation of the Liberty Fund, and the Liberty Fund, some of the members of the board at any rate. I chatted about it with Neil, and he spoke with the board. And we called it the Pierre F. Goodrich Conservation Award. And the Irv Rice. Irv, you may recall I discussed the creation of this with you back those many years ago. And you filled me in on the story of Meadowlark Farms and so forth. And that was the context. That was the history that I used to create this award. And the first recipient was one of Dave Kennedy's friends from Wyoming, Dave True. I had worked on his ranches when I was in college, and I knew some of the work that Dave had done and Dave True had done. And it seemed to me that clearly Dave True was a good and honorable recipient. And I looked around for other business people who had really done something significant in terms of advancing environmental quality or ecological understanding or in some truly significant way, the way that Pierre Goodrich had. And so the second recipient of that award came 3 years later, and that was Arthur Temple Jr. Of Diboll, Texas, who was the owner of a very large timber stand, 1.9 million acres, in which he had basically revolutionized that part of southern forestry and integrated southern forestry with wildlife management, and it created a 17,000-acre experimental forest and wildlife area, hiring PhD wildlife biologists and so forth to work with foresters. He also, incidentally, integrated the schools, the public schools of Diboll, Texas in 1947, 48, and 49, simply because he thought that was the right thing to do. And he had enough power and ownership to do it. And that in itself is a really nice story. The way he did it, which was very, well, it was a wonderful move in my judgment. He was way ahead of the state and far more effective. And then I, quite frankly, ran out of candidates. And I've been looking ever since, and I've solicited nominees and so forth. And it's really hard to find business people who have done really significant projects or come up with important ideas of the magnitude of Pierre Goodrich. I could obviously come up with people who I could sort of give an award to, but I'm afraid I would have to lower the standards a bit, and I've not been quite willing to do that. My new neighbor, Ted Turner. Ted Turner bought the Flying D Ranch, and he's done, from strictly an environmental standpoint, he's done some really quite spectacular things. But I still think he's quite of the, he and his wife, Jane, I don't think they merit that award. So anyway, we haven't given that award for some time, but I'm eager to do so again. By the way, I just came here from Diboll, Texas, back on Arthur Temple's place. Well, at any rate, let me now move on to trade associations. It seems to me fairly clearly that the most amoral organizations in the United States are almost surely trade associations. I have worked with quite a number of them. I was a member of the National Petroleum Council, thanks to Danny Boggs' nomination and perhaps whatever else he did to make that happen. There are three academics who have been members. I've been active in a number of agricultural organizations. I think that agriculture is a genetic defect. As a matter of fact, I've been in it for 5 generations, my wife for 4. We can't get out of it somehow. We're involved in yet another one. So I've had a lot of associations with Montana Stockman's Association, with Montana Wool Growers, national associations of various sorts. Now we're into a fairly significant orchard out in the desert of Washington State. And the trade associations, as near as I can tell, are strictly opportunistic and unprincipled. I'm not saying that they do things that are illegal, although they'll do those too if they can get away with it. But basically they tend to view, as near as I can tell, they tend to view the state as essentially an engine for generating plunder, and what they want to do is capture, control the levers of that engine to direct the plunder toward their members. So at any rate, one could imagine trade associations being strong advocates for harmonizing economic progress with good environmental management, but in my experience, they never are. Now, they pretend to be once in a while. But basically, I see them over the secular trend moving towards strategic and opportunistic positions. And maybe my sample size isn't huge. I mean, I have not exhausted the universe, but I feel fairly confident that I'm correct in those statements. Montana Wool Growers and National Wool Growers are the organizations I know best, and they're absolutely, as near as I can tell, strictly opportunistic and hypocritical when it comes to matters of this sort. Well, I think that probably that is going to get worse. And I think it's going to get worse because of selective processes. By the way, I have this position that economics and ecology, behavioral ecology or evolutionary biology, are really the same discipline. So I often will speak of economics in evolutionary terms, but I really think it's that the paradigms are almost perfectly isomorphic. But at any rate, I think the situation will probably get worse as international competition increases. Clearly, economic integration at the international level is going forward. And what that means is that the competitive pressures and the margins are ever smaller. And so the sort of slack that a person like Arthur Temple had to set aside 17,000 acres of productive timberland and basically say, hey, this is an experiment and it may not pay off, it won't pay off any quicker than a generation, and it may be several, but we can do that. The competition today is such that I think it's going to be ever more unusual to find people who have the opportunities and the control to basically allocate resources in that way. And as we have pension fund managers monitoring the performance of corporations, I think the ability of people to take risks of that sort will continue to diminish. So I cannot be at all optimistic in terms of the economic evolution that I at least anticipate as far out as I can see, which isn't very far. Well, might economists have something to say that would be useful and helpful in terms of dealing with the above situation? Because as I said, I absolutely firmly believe that we have captured the intellectual high ground in terms of environmental policy and environmental economics. And there I have to be sort of pessimistic again in terms of economists actually being very useful. For one thing, most of economics, I think, has devolved into recreational arithmetic. My son is a PhD student at the University of Chicago now, and he isn't studying economics. He's studying math and he's studying statistics, and that's at the University of Chicago. And it's not by choice. I mean, he wants to study institutional economics and political economy and things of this sort, but the hurdles keep going up, the mathematical hurdles of the 40, he told me, he may be wrong, but he told me of the 40 students that they've, the new students, PhD students in economics, only 10 are Americans, and quite a few of the others already have, as an Israeli who has a PhD in physics, and a Russian with a PhD in mathematics, and a Pakistani who already has a PhD in statistics, and so forth. And that's at Chicago. Well, the other thing is, when you're dealing with economists, no matter how good the analytic tools when they look at these problems, you know that there's something wrong when you're working with people who think that calculus is the most compelling form of communication. I mean, they are just not likely to make much progress in advancing what I think are the really important goals. So I really must say that in terms of looking at business and in terms of looking at economics and looking at environmentalism from those perspectives, I simply cannot be very optimistic. And again, I'm going to say it for the third time, even though we have captured the intellectual high ground. And yet, of course, I'm an entrepreneur, so I am obviously hardwired optimistic. I do see some serious grounds to be optimistic about improvements in environmental policy. And excuse me, let me run over very quickly what I think they might be. I'm hesitant to say this in Forrest McDonald's presence, so Forrest, I'm just going to ask you to be quiet. Because I'm probably wrong, okay, and I don't want to be beat up until I'm done. The U.S. was clearly a great experiment by people who understood that government basically has been, throughout almost all of history, an engine for the relatively efficient generation of plunder. The creation of the United States Constitution was a radical experiment, and we ran that experiment for roughly 100 years. That experiment basically had government standing aside, creating a context in which people could, subject to the rule of willing consent, truck and barter and exchange and so forth. Transactions costs were kept relatively low and so forth. And we had what I think was probably the most successful large-scale social experiment in the history of the world for roughly 100 years. The United States, obviously, however, was not a bucolic utopia. Obviously, there were huge problems in the way in our treatment of Indians, of blacks, of women, and so forth, but that's not what I'm interested in at the moment. What we did find at the end of roughly 100 years as we looked around, what the progressives found was basically a lot of things gone very seriously awry in terms of what we now call our environment. And this gave rise to the progressives and the original conservation movement. And what they did, essentially in 1897, I'm just picking that date for the creation of the National Forests. We could pick a few other dates, I'll pick that one. We had the launching of the Great American Counter-Revolution with the advent of scientific management, with the presumption that we could select fine young men of good breeding and character, give them the best of scientific training, enable them to finesse the arrow paradox and aggregate disparate preferences, and hence see what we wanted as a society. We would then strip these fine young men of good breeding and character of self-interest. We would insulate them from political pressure, and we would then turn them loose to manage, in Gifford Pinchot's words, for the greatest good, for the greatest number, for the long run. That was the start of the Great American Counter-Revolution, in which government would have an active role in managing and coordinating and so forth. And until, I'm not quite sure of the year, but I think it was 1954, until sometime in the 1950s, the U.S. Forest Service actually had as its goal the taking over and management, in a fascistic way, the private forests of the United States, as well as the 191.5 million acres of national forests. Well, we have run this experiment, this counter-revolution, now for 100 years, and the data is in, and it's clear, and it's unambiguous. And that is, that experiment of Sylvan socialism, like every other experiment in socialism, aside from my beloved Hutterites, has failed totally and miserably. And it has failed in just the way that Dan Shiro described the failures in Eastern Europe. So we have massive empirical evidence that in terms of ethics, in terms of equity, in terms of economic efficiency, and in terms of ecological integrity, the scientific management command and control approach to environmental management is an absolute failure. There is no way, no place at the national level of the United States that it has approached anything resembling success. And people understand that. Now, some people understand that. Now, it turns out, of course, that many, the Gang of Ten, the big environmental groups, Sierra Club, Wilderness Society, and so forth, they are hostage to their success in terms of members and money and so forth, and they have become crisis entrepreneurs, always having to find or trump up new crises to generate that they create, they either manufacture or else they amplify. And then they provide avenues down which people can parade their good intentions by sending checks and membership monies and so forth. So they're locked into crisis entrepreneurial activities. However, there is a group of people who, most of whom are perfectly innocent of economic training, but they're relatively smart and they're relatively honest, and they are interested in environmental matters, and they write about this stuff. And they write for magazines like Harper's and The Atlantic, and they might write even for some of the environmental magazines. And they basically understand that something dramatically is amiss, and that they have been lied to in a systematic way, and the moral underpinnings, as well as the scientific underpinnings of the scientific management paradigm, they're gone. That edifice is about to collapse, and one of my roles in life is to help dynamite that son of a gun. And that means mobilizing people who are smart and who do not think that calculus is the most compelling form of communication. And so my latest venture is to create a new organization called the Gallatin Institute. FREE, the Foundation for Research on Economics and the Environment, does what it's always done. It involves economists and policy analysts and some scientists in doing political economy analysis. And we have a very active program for federal judges and for some writers and so forth, and for academics. And we continue to publish books like environmental gore. But this new venture is really quite different. We're involved with poets and philosophers and historians and so forth, trying to teach people who are, as I say, perfectly innocent of formal economic training, the basic principles of institutional analysis and design, people who are intelligent and who are interested in environmental matters, and we are, in fact, bringing together a group of people who understand that the current system is intellectually and ethically flawed and who are looking for alternatives. And I come back now, now that my time is within a minute of being up, I cycle back to the Liberty Fund and tell you that our next program, the next program of the Gallatin Institute, will be held at the Gallatin Gateway Inn on the Gallatin River in Gallatin County, in the shadow of the Gallatin Mountains in Montana. And we will take the book, I'll Take My Stand, from the Agrarians, and we were going to look at that book and see if we can apply the lessons of that book to the environmental movement in the West, another land-based and regionally oriented organization. And I've used my 20 minutes. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.